Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The sales of Henrietta Lacks launched a medical revolution, and the story behind it inspired a high school biology student to great things. Joining me today is that student, Rebecca Skloot, to talk about Henrietta Lacks and her Skloot's new book about Henrietta's life and what it means to the rest of us, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Rebecca is a science writer. Her work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, O, the Oprah Magazine, Discover, Columbia Journalism Review, among many others. She blogs at Culture Disc, hosted by Seed Magazine, and she does a lot of other stuff. You can learn more about that from our links on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me.
Henrietta Lacks had cervical cancer in 1950-51. She went to Johns Hopkins for treatments. While there, they took her cells. And even before she died, just months later in 1951, they discovered that her cells were very, very special. Tell us.
Yeah. So she was 30 years old, and she went to Johns Hopkins with cervical cancer. And before treating her cancer, without her knowledge, her doctor took this extra piece of her tumor and put it in a dish and sent that dish down the hall to George Guy, who was the head of tissue culture research at Hopkins. And he'd been trying to grow human cells in culture for decades, and it never worked. There was this big goal of a lot of scientists to create what's called an immortal human cell line, one that grows indefinitely in the lab and just sort of never dies. And though all the cells before hers died, Henrietta's just never did. So her cells are still alive today, almost 60 years later. And she died soon after. The cancer that grew was incredibly virulent. It grew just as fast in her body as it did in the lab. And her cells went on to become sort of one of the most important things that happened to medicine.
When George Guy was looking for the immortal tissue, the immortal cells, was he always just looking at cancer cells?
He was mainly interested in cancer because he was he and a lot of other scientists had this hope that if you could grow human cancer outside the body, that you could study it in ways that you couldn't inside the body. You know, at this point, they didn't know the difference between a normal cell and a cancer cell. They didn't understand why cancer cells divided so much faster. And so all the basics of cancer, they didn't know. So he was particularly interested in that, but he was also just trying to grow anything that would grow. So he took cells from, you know, himself, his kids, anyone who walked into Hopkins. He wasn't picky.
That's kind of the way it is sometimes at the start of something. They called it the HeLa cell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is short for Henrietta and Lacks. So it's the first two letters of her first and last name.
So they had tried cancer cells before. This wasn't new. But hers, it's sort of amazing when you think about it. To this day, there still aren't very many examples like her out there.
Yeah, there are other immortal cell lines now. You can actually now immortalize a cell. So you can take a normal cell and change it with a virus or various things to make it immortal. But this sort of spontaneously immortal cell like hers, is still very rare. And even among immortal cells, hers is unusual. Her cell line is unusual. Her cells grow with this sort of unbelievable robustness. Scientists joke that you could grow them on a doorknob or in a sink drain. They're just incredibly tough. So they're often used for teaching purposes because they're sort of hard to kill as far as cell cultures go. So they're very hardy, and they can grow in these massive quantities, which is also unusual, particularly at the time.
The book, as I read it, and I enjoyed it very much, is sort of operates, in my mind at least, along two big parallels: the life of Henrietta Lacks and the life of her descendants, mm-hmm. the lives of her descendants, and then also the ethics surrounding the issue of taking her cells without her permission at the time was not that unusual. But even today, you sort of trace the whole history of medical ethics in terms of cells and things haven't changed that much. So first, let's talk about Henrietta and why you decided not just to write about her cell line and its amazing qualities, but about the person.
Yeah. Well, you know, the book, like you said, sort of traces – you can trace so much of the history of modern medicine through just these landmarks that her cells were involved in. You know, they went up in the first space missions. They were, you know, used to – helped develop the polio vaccine. Hers were the first cells ever cloned. Her genes were some of the first ever mapped. I mean, you know, I don't know of any other moment in history.
How many tons of her cells are out there? That's a shocking.
Yeah, it's really 50, amazing.
50,000 or something?
Oh, far more. Yeah. So there, back in the 50s, a factory was started that they were mass producing her cells to the tune of about 3 trillion a week and sending them around to labs around the world. And yeah, it's been estimated that, you know, if you could gather all her cells together and weigh them, that they'd weigh more than 50 million metric tons.
50 million, okay.
Which is, you know, that's like more than 150 Empire State Buildings. It's sort of an inconceivable
Goes around
thing.
The world like six
yeah,
times or
wrap
something
around the world. And yeah, and cells weigh almost nothing. So it's just, it's sort of inconceivable how many of her cells that are there. So, you know, there's all of these incredible cells and they came from this one woman. You know, and the way that I sort of structured the book, and it sort of interweaves the story of Henrietta, the history of all this medicine, the research done on her cells, and the bioethics, and then also very much the story of her family. And to me, the immortal life part of it is it's both the life of her cells and also what happened to the family afterwards. You know, they didn't know that these cells were taken until several decades after she died, when scientists decided to track down her kids and do research on them in order to learn more about the cells. So her kids, you know, when her husband got this phone call one day, you know, he had a third grade education. He didn't even know what cells were. And the way he understood the call was, you know, we've got your wife. She's alive in a laboratory. We've been doing research on her for the last 25 years. And now we have to test your kids to see if they have cancer, which wasn't what the scientist said at all. But the family didn't understand that. And, you know, his understanding was that they had her in a cell. That was his only sort of reference point for the word cell. So her family got sucked into this world of research they didn't understand. And sort of part of the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks is all of this stuff that happened to her family, you know, used in research. There were, you know, at some point her medical records were released and published by the press. So there's this sort of long saga of things that followed just that one moment of taking this woman's tissues and growing them in culture. So, you know, that was my motivation behind telling the whole story, was to look at the many different ways that, you know, tissues are actually linked to people, the big ethical issues that can come up when you're doing research on them. And yeah, you're right. It has some, in a lot of ways, it hasn't changed much. You know, today, most people in the United States have their tissue on file somewhere being used in research. And most people don't really realize it. You know, you go to the doctor and they take a biopsy and you sign a form that says you can dispose of my tissues any way you see fit.
That's we think they're saying, means. Is it the garbage disposal or is it the wastebasket?
Right.
But
yeah, and sometimes it'll also say you can use it for educational research purposes. And, you know, but most people just, they don't ask questions. They don't know what this means. So, you know, most tissues are out there being used in research, and that's a good thing. You know, our most important sort of medical advances and vaccines and drugs come from that research. But people get a little unnerved when they find out that there are some cells are out there somewhere and they didn't realize it, particularly when you start talking about money being involved.
Right. If you're just joining All Sides with Ann Fisher, my guest is Rebecca Skloot. She is the author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Rebecca is in the studio with me today because she's in town today for a reading tonight at OSU. You can learn more about that by going to RebeccaSkloot.com/events or just go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll have the link there for you. How important was it to have Henrietta's name in the title of the book, Rebecca?
Oh, for me, it was absolutely essential. You know, and it was an interesting one just in terms of the book itself. Most scientists, you know, millions of scientists out there have used her cells, and most of them think they came from a woman named Helen Lane. So there was this pseudonym out there for a long time. And part of the story is really, you know, I mean, the family, once her identity was released, it was very upsetting to the family that people still thought she was Helen Lane. So they were like, well, you know, we've been through all this sort of traumatic stuff, and we now know that this happened to her and her identity has been released, but people are still saying it was Helen Lane. And so having her name in the title is very important. And so for me was, you know, it's not super visible, but the H-E and the L-A in her name are bolded.
Yes,
so
right.
They sort
yeah.
of pop out a little
I
bit.
I didn't notice it before.
And that was sort of important to me, too, just to, even if you don't notice it right on first glance, like it's there and the sort of.
Actually, as I'm looking at this extremely colorful and really beautiful book, what do you call it? The cover of the book.
Yeah.
That's her cells.
Mm-hmm.
It's hot pink and bright orange and yellow.
Yeah.
And they are her cells. And then on top of that is superimposed a black and white photograph, really the only one anyone has of her as an adult.
Yeah, there are two pictures of her. And the one that's on the cover, she's sort of standing there on the porch of her house with her hands on her hips. And I love this picture because she's sort of sassy. And it's this very ubiquitous picture. So this photo at some point was released as well. So it was published again and again and again in the press and in, you know, science books. And it would often have Helen Lane as the caption. So somehow her image got released but not attached to her name. And when I first learned about the cells and I tracked down this picture of her, the version I saw had the caption Helen Lane, Helen Larson, or Henrietta Lacks, a.k.a. Hela. So this idea that her identity was both released and lost at the same time is sort of part of the story.
You mentioned the demeanor of her in this photograph, kind of sassy looking.
Mm-hmm.
She was, ironically, or maybe not so ironically, coincidentally, or however, extremely strong personality, very vivid personality, like her cells.
Yeah. Yes, and this is something that the family has often talked about, that they, their understanding of what the cells are is very different from scientists' understanding of what they are. You know, for the family, for Deborah, her daughter in particular, you know, her mother's soul is very much alive in these cells. And, you know, she would ask scientists, you know, if you're sending my mother's cells to the moon, you know, can she rest in peace? And when you inject her with chemicals, does that somehow hurt her? And she would ask them, can you look in her cells and tell me what her favorite color was? And did she like to dance? And, you know, so she very much believed that these cells were also her mother in a very sort of real way. And so for the family, the fact that the cells actually behave a lot like Henrietta makes perfect sense. So, you know, they believe that her cells are essentially, that she was essentially an angel brought back to life in these cells to cure diseases and to help people. And, you know, she's a very, as you said, a very strong woman. And if you make her mad, you'll feel it. And, you know, Henrietta's cells have caused some problems for science. They at various points had contaminated lots of other cultures.
Because they're so aggressive.
So aggressive, and they would overgrow anything else that they came into contact with. So they caused millions of dollars in damage by contaminating things and being so powerful. And, you know, and her family, they just sort of chuckle about that. They say, one of the lines that I love the most that Deborah says in response to that is, you know, that was just Henrietta getting back at the scientists for causing problems for the family. You know, you don't mess with Henrietta because she'll say Hela on you and you don't want that. And, you know, but she was this sort of super mother. You know, she had five kids by the time she was 30. She really wanted more. She was incredibly devoted to them. And she took care of everyone else, too. So her house was known to be the place where if you didn't have any money that month, you could go eat at Henrietta's house anytime. She always had food on the stove and you could sleep on her floor if you didn't have a place. So she just took care of everyone. So for her family, it's like, of course, she's, you know,
out there taking care of the rest of the
world. She's come back to life as these cells that are curing diseases and helping millions of people.
We're going to have to take a quick break. My guest is Rebecca Skloot. She is the author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. We'll take calls and emails when we return. Go to 614-292-8513 for those calls and allsides@wosu.org for those emails if you want to join the conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, as Iraq prepares for a crucial vote, bombs are still exploding. But is a national stability emerging that will let the U.S. go? We'll ask. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins later this afternoon at 1 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 29 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20. Sunshine today and a high of 38 degrees. Clear skies tonight and a little chilly overnight, a low right around 20. Mostly sunny for Friday and a high of 38, and sunny on Saturday as well with a high of 45 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is journalist and author Rebecca Skloot. She wrote The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lack. She's traveling all over the place doing readings and meeting people and talking about her book. It is of great interest to a lot of people because it affects just about everyone. In fact, I can't imagine anybody it doesn't affect. If you've ever taken anything stronger than an aspirin, your life has probably been changed because of Henrietta Lacks. Her cells, the HeLa cell line, the immortal cell line of HeLa, has been used in too much research to count, tens and tens of thousands of experiments and that kind of thing. And Rebecca, you became interested in it when you were taking a college course, but you were a sophomore in high school. I didn't quite get it. Tell us about how you ended up learning about Henrietta Lacks.
Yeah, so I was a sort of a derelict kid. I was finding myself, yes. I was bored in school is what we always say now. Didn't agree well with the traditional schooling system. And I had gone to the, you know, regular public high school, and I failed my freshman year of high school because I just didn't go. I just had no interest whatsoever. And in fact, I actually would skip school and go to the alternative school nearby, which is where a lot of my friends went, even though I wasn't enrolled there. So I ended up switching schools and going to this alternative high school that is sort of a hippie school. You know, this was Portland, Oregon, and it was very laid back. You know, teachers all went by their first names, and there was no science class. We had dream studies and art therapy. And
you actually studied dreams.
Yeah, yeah. No, we had a class that was called dream studies. And we would, our homework was that we had to write down our dreams and analyze them. And we would talk about them in class. It was very Freudian. And, but I knew I wanted to be a veterinarian. And so I knew that I had to take science classes at some point, and I also needed to do it to graduate from high school. So when I was 16, I signed up for just a basic biology class at the local community college for high school credit. So this was one of the ways that this alternative school sort of existed, was that it let students
pawned
take classes
other
places. And so I signed up for this class, and I was just totally over my head. I'd never taken, no science whatsoever. And I was sitting there with a bunch of, college kids, and my teacher was talking about, we were talking about cells and cancer, and he said, there are these cells, and they've been alive since 1951. And, biology teachers love to talk about these because they have this sci-fi thing that students really get into. And he'd say, there are more of her cells now than there ever were of her. And then he wrote her name in really big print on the board. He wrote Henrietta Lacks, and he said she was Black. And then that was it. And class was over, and he erased the board. And I was like, why do we know that? And who is she? And what's her story? And what else do we know? And did she have kids? And I went up to him after class, and I said, what else do we know about this woman? And he just said, that's it. And he said, if you want to go do a little research, write up a little extra credit paper. I'll give you some points, at the end of the semester.
Did you?
And I went home and I tried to find some things. I'm not a very ambitious kid at that point. So I went home, looked in the encyclopedia for Henrietta Lacks. It wasn't there. And that was the extent of my research. But then it just stuck with me. And I was going to be a veterinarian. I had no intention of being a writer. But then so throughout school, I would do, little research projects with her cells and things. And then once I started writing, I was still sort of fixated on this. And I decided I wanted to try and see if I could find her family. And so, many years later, when I finished the book and got the pre-publication galleys, I tracked down that biology teacher and I sent it to him. And, he's retired, and I sent him with a note, Dear Mr. Deffler, here's my extra credit paper. It's about 25 years late, but
did he remember you by any chance?
He did, only because we had a sort of a different run-in that he didn't remember anything about the Henrietta Lacks stuff, but he did remember me. I think probably in part because I was this weird, very young kid in his class. And so it's just something that stuck with me from that very young age. And it's funny, people have often sort of said, it took me almost 12 years to actually write the book. The family wouldn't, it took me a year and a half to convince them to even talk to me. And when the roadblocks that appeared while writing this book were just sort of never ending. And a lot of people have said, you know, why did you keep doing this? And my parents love telling these stories because, you know, they say this gives hope to parents of derelict kids everywhere, because part of what, you know, I'm really hard-headed and, you know, somebody tells me not to do something, I'm going to do it. And that was really awful for my parents when I was a kid. But, yeah, it has its benefits later in life.
Stick-to-itiveness. Yeah. The story is as much about that search for the truth as it is. And you're part of the story, yeah, and your experience with the family. And it made it very enjoyable to read, by the way. Sometimes you're like, hey, you know, journalists, you don't insert yourself in the story. But this was the whole experience, getting to know them and getting them to trust you was part of that story.
Yeah, and I was really resistant about that. I teach writing, and I'm always harping on my students and saying, don't insert yourselves into stories where you don't belong. It's like, to me, it's the cardinal sin of journalism when people do this. And so as I was working on the book, I would, you know, go out and, you know, part of the way I won the trust of the family was by saying, hey, I'm not hiding anything from you. You can come with me when I do my research. And so Deborah Lax would come with me on a lot of these trips, and we would sort of travel around going to laboratories, and she was learning about her mother's
cells. Deborah Lax is her youngest child, right?
Yeah. And, well, it's her youngest daughter. Yeah.
Okay.
And along the way, sort of crazy things were happening. And you know, Deborah would occasionally, you know, she would trust me for a while, and then she would get very suspicious and worry that maybe Hopkins had sent me to take her cells, and that if we went into a laboratory, they were going to do research on her, and she'd never come out. And she had such deep fears because of all of the things she'd been through that, you know, our relationship was this sort of, you know, 10 steps forward, 5 steps back kind of thing. And then, you know, there were faith healings. There was something that really sort of seemed a lot like an exorcism, where there's, you know, someone laying hands on Deborah and saying, you know, Lord, she can't take these cells anymore, and sort of putting them into me. You know, he sort of put his hands on my head and said, give them to her. And I would come home from my reporting trips with these stories and tell my family and my agent, and they would all say, you have to put this in the book. This is part of the story. Their reaction to you, the fear that is coming from, you know, what they're going through with, you know, when you talk to them, is all shows what they've been through and the impact these cells have had on them. And I would say, no, this is their story. This is not my story. I'm not going to be in this thing. And even Deborah eventually was like, well, what are you talking about? You have to be in the story. She would say, don't you make me be in that book by myself. And I did come to realize at a certain point that I really had no choice but to put myself in. And
I can't imagine it without it.
Yeah. And so much of it is, you know, because I became another character in the story. I was another person who came along sort of wanting something from the family and affected their lives very deeply. You know, Deborah would never have gone into these labs to see her mother's cells, and she would have never done these, what we did together. And some of that was pretty traumatic for her. In the end, I think it was very good. She really was able to sort of come to a place where she could really understand the cells more and sort of reconcile her relationship to them. But, you know, I felt like it would just be dishonest to leave it out at a certain point.
Henrietta's home community in the Baltimore area, now it slipped my mind the name of that neighborhood.
Turner Station.
Turner Station. You went there.
Yeah.
It was one of the, you know, when you found out that that's where she was from, you decided there's only one way to do this, and that's just drive around until you find this particular location. Talk about that day, because it's a tough part of town, and you stood out like a sore thumb.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And this happened sort of again and again in my early reporting of the book, because, you know, the family wouldn't talk to me. And so I realized that what I had to do was go find her distant relatives and find the places where she lived. And she I, you know, got in my car, and, you know, I had this a really old Toyota Prelude Honda Prelude that the muffler had fallen off.
Yes.
So I not only was I the only white girl driving around town, but I was driving around town in this car that was like, and so
look at me.
Yeah, it's just like putting a blinking red light on top of my car. And, you know, and I was, you know, it was sort of scary. You know, I was in my 20s. I'd never done anything like this before. I was a grad student. You know, I was a grad student with a science degree. I had not taken any journalism classes. And, you know, so I was just basically going door to door and not knowing what I would find. And, yeah, there were some moments where that was pretty scary. And, like, it took me sometimes several passes of driving by somebody's house to actually get out of the car and go knock on their doors. And
at Turner Corner.
Yeah, Turner Station.
Turner Station, sorry.
That's okay.
I got to write it down.
Yeah.
You were looking for a store, like you were picturing as a corner, sort of a convenience type store, but it wasn't what you were looking for. And you drove around and around, and these guys were sitting on a porch watching you go round and round and round. Tell about that, because it was was fun. It was
So the store that I was looking for was the store of a woman who had been trying very hard to get sort of recognition for Henrietta for a long time. Courtney Speed is her name, and you know, the store is in a trailer that's, you know, has been broken into so many times that she stopped bothering to replace the windows. So it's just this sort of windowless trailer with bars on the windows, and there's no sign that says that it's a store. There's just some Bible scripture on the front. And so, but it was on the spot where there was supposed to be this store. And so I did. I just kept driving around, and it took me a long time to sort of get up the courage. I was just sort of afraid to get out of the car and say, "Excuse me, where's the store?" Which, of course, was where they were standing. And it was just as a learning experience for me as a young person, as a reporter, you know, it was a really formative sort of time for me in terms of getting over those fears that any young journalist has about, you know, picking up the phone and calling someone they don't know, or walking up to someone's house and just saying, "Hi, I'm here to talk to you," and not knowing what they're going to find. I mean, that's something that all young journalists have to struggle with. And I sort of threw myself at, you know, my parents have always said, "Well, you never were one to do anything lightly."
Yeah,
you know?
So I just like, there was no graduated.
But it was great. You know, the moment that they would hear, people would hear what I was there to do.
They knew exactly why you were there. Everybody knew about Henrietta's cells.
Right.
When you called her husband the first time, it's like, you know, "Papa, there's somebody here who wants to talk to you about Henrietta's cells."
Right. Without me even saying. I mean, that was one of those moments that, you know, when I called her husband for the first time, a young boy answered the phone. I mean, he couldn't have been more than like maybe 7, 8 years old. And I just said, "Can I talk to David?" And he just said, "Somebody's on the phone about your wife's cells." Like, he knew just from the sound of my voice, because I was white. And the only time white people called David Lacks was when they wanted something from the family having to do with the cells. And even a, you know, really young boy knew that, which was really – and that was incredible to me. And that was – I didn't know anything that had happened to the family at that point, because they weren't talking to me. And so I knew just from those little moments something very big happened to the family, and that they'd been pretty traumatized, and I needed to figure out what that was in order to understand the story and why they were resistant.
If you want to talk with Rebecca Skloot, author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, you can call 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email now from Dawn. She writes, "I owe my graduate education to Henrietta. I used HeLa cells and HeLa cell DNA to study human genes. I always called the cells Helen's cells. I knew she was an African-American woman, and that made me proud. I thought she knew her cells were being used. I understand her family's concerns, and thank you, Rebecca, for uncovering the true story. Research is so important, but we need the public's help and consent so that we do not cross ethical lines. I can't wait to read the book."
Thank you so much. That I'm sitting here with goosebumps. I can't tell you the number of emails that I get like that. There are so many scientists out there who have spent their entire careers working with HeLa cells. You know, the number of people who did their entire dissertations using her cells. And across the board, their response to the book has been essentially, "Oh, my God, I had no idea." There are a few people like Dawn who thought, "Okay, there's a person behind these cells." But most people didn't even wonder that. You know, HeLa cells are sort of almost like an inanimate object,
like
in the
Kleenex
labs.
Yeah. Like they're just...
There's the test tubes, there's the fruit flies, there's the lab mice, and then there's the HeLa, and they're just always there. And nobody stops to think about where they came from. And one of my motivations behind writing the book, you know, was obviously telling the story of this family and what they'd been through. And, you know, to me, the story is about, in some ways, about the fact that there is a human being behind every single biological sample in a lab. And there are millions, you know, billions of those out there now. And most people don't stop to think about that. And, you know, and so the response, a lot of people have assumed that scientists would be, you know, angry about this story or defensive in some way. And some of them, there definitely have been a few of those where they're worried that this book is going to give people the idea that they should have the right to control their cells, or, you know, that there should be new regulations, which a lot of people would say, well, there probably should be. So there's a lot of concern that this is going to make it more difficult to do research on tissues. But that's an absolute minority. I mean, the most scientists are just really sort of thankful to know the story, and they want to do something for the family. I mean, this is, again and again, scientists have said, you know, what can I do to help them and to sort of thank them? And, you know, this is one thing as a reporter, when I first started working on the book, I struggled with, you know, my role in it and not wanting to be another person who sort of came along and benefited from the family in some way without doing something in return. And so I've set up a Henrietta Lacks Foundation. It's at henriettalacksfoundation.org, and it's a scholarship. It's going to be, among other things, a scholarship fund that will benefit the descendants of Henrietta Lacks, so that they can hopefully go to school, hopefully get some health insurance coverage for her kids, who are still uninsured to this day.
A very poor family, pretty much across the board.
Absolutely, yeah, and you know they don't have access to the medical advances that their mother's cells helped develop. I mean that. That's in so many ways at the heart of this story. It's at the heart of the health insurance debate right now. You know, this book is a lot about class and access to health care and access to education. So some of the book's proceeds are going in there, and then scientists have been donating individually. It's interesting. I had one scientist who said on Twitter, you know, I'm going to put $1 in there every time I passage HeLa cells, like grow a new batch of HeLa cells. And then for a while there was $1, and then the next day there was $1 and $1 and $1. And then they stopped, and then there was like $7, and then that stopped. And there's like, and you know, I think one of the things that happened was this guy realized, whoa,
this could get expensive.
Well, and it just, I could be on this website like every day.
Uh-huh.
You know, but there, it has been really kind of wonderful to see scientists' response.
She was very poor. She was an indigent patient at Johns Hopkins. She died a very painful and drawn-out death.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, one of the questions that I often get is about the sort of racial elements of the story.
Yes.
You know, she was in the colored ward at Hopkins. It was segregated. And, you know, for generations, her story has been held up as one of, you know, a poor black woman who, you know, was taken advantage of by this, you know, sort of white racist scientist who knew her cells were valuable and stole them from her and got rich. And none of that is actually what happened. George Guy didn't know that she was black until well after the cells grew. He was taking cells from everybody. He had no idea whose would be useful and not. You know, but the reality remains that the reason she was at Hopkins was because she was poor and she was black. It was the only place she could get treated. So the public wards at Hopkins, which were where black patients were treated and, you know, white people, anyone who couldn't afford treatment anywhere else, were often the site of research. And, you know, across the country, there was this sort of belief that if someone was in the public wards, they were getting for free, it was sort of their duty to
kind
give
of fair game.
Yes, right. It's like their payment was, you know, was the research materials. And there are some people who still sort of feel that way, but not many.
We will get back to that issue of how the research was done back then when we return with Rebecca Skloot, author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. When we return, we'll talk about the Ohio connection to Henrietta Lacks. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Corporate partners help provide support for WOSU 820. Your business can join them and reach an educated, engaged, appreciative audience every day. Your business will also be associated with a trusted source for national and local news, arts, and culture. For more information, contact Christine Schottich at 247-4469. And thanks for supporting WOSU 820, NPR News.
And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of the program will be here, and we'll hear about the legacy of Coretta Scott King and A Song for Coretta, a play that explores her impact on the lives of five fictional African-American women. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU. And be sure to tune in for a special All Sides with Ann Fisher on Monday, March 8th at 10 o'clock. The program will broadcast from Cup of Joe in the Short North and will preview WOSU's television documentary, Columbus Neighborhoods. The first of six shows debuts Monday night at 8 on WOSU-TV and shows the history of the revitalized Short North neighborhood. But you can learn more about the project and get a preview of the documentary on All Sides with Ann Fisher Monday morning at 10, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 29 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine and a high of 38 today. Clear tonight and a low around 20. All Sides continues.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Rebecca Skloot. She wrote The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. She is speaking tonight at 7 p.m. at OSU. If you want more information on that, go to WOSU.org/allsides, or you can go to Rebecca Skloot, that's RebeccaSkloot.com/events. Rebecca, at the time, the same sort of attitude that or lack of conscientiousness about Henrietta Lacks's cells pervaded science at the time, and it was at the same time that they were doing the Tuskegee syphilis studies and others, including one at the Ohio State Penitentiary. Can you talk about the interplay of all that? And
yeah, you know, the story of Henrietta Lacks is, yeah, it's sort of in some ways part of this long, very sort of dark history of research on African Americans without their consent. And one of the things that I wanted to do with this book, I mean, when I went into this, I didn't know. I was very curious. What role did race play in all of this? Did they do research on her, you know, because she was black? Was this another Tuskegee, which is what people often ask about? And, you know, and as I said earlier, it's sort of much more complicated than that. She definitely was at Hopkins because she was black. A lot of people were having their cells taken. But it does, you know, it fits into this sort of larger story. And some of it is very much about class and the fact that, you know, this would have absolutely happened to, you know, anyone at that time period if they had been poor or black or often both. And so, yeah, you can sort of trace the history of a lot of these important bioethical questions, bioethical issues through the story of her cells. You mentioned the Ohio connection.
The Ohio State Penitentiary.
Yeah, there was this, so not long after Henrietta's death, I mean, it was about 10 years, I guess, actually, this one scientist decided that in order to see, to try to understand more about cancer, he started using HeLa cells in research on people without their knowledge. So, you know, they were Henrietta's cells are live cancer cells, and he thought that cancer was caused by a virus. And a lot of this was a big, you know, area of research at that point. They were looking for the cancer virus, thinking if they could find it, they could come up with a vaccine. Obviously, there's more than one, and we now know much more about that. But, you know, so he was trying to see, was it a virus? Was it some sort of an immune problem? So he started taking live HeLa cells and injecting them into people without their knowledge. He started off with some cancer patients in a hospital, and he would inject her cells, and they would often grow. They would grow into these little tumors on people's arms where they had been injected, and then he would, you know, cut the tumors off or sometimes leave them. Often their immune systems would fight them off eventually. There are a few cases where they actually metastasized, and the people who were he was doing this with didn't know it. But they were all sort of immune compromised in some way. They were already sick and they were in a hospital. So he really needed, he believed, to do this with people with healthy immune systems to see if they fought off the cancer in a way that the cancer patients hadn't, because that to him would have said, okay, then something is wrong with cancer patients that lets this grow. So he came here to Columbus and to the prison that was here, the Ohio State Penitentiary. The Ohio State Penitentiary. And he put a little ad in their, you know, penitentiary newsletter that said looking for volunteers for research. And hundreds of men in the penitentiary volunteered to have HeLa cells injected into them for this research. And, you know, today you can't do that kind of research on prisoners. We, you know, they're a sort of captive population. You can't really get informed consent in the way that we know you need to, you know, now. They of course thought this would help shorten their sentences, or, you know,
and some of them thought to do something for humanity.
Yeah, some of them said this. Yeah, right. So when reporters interviewed them, they would say, you know, I did something awful, you know, to a person. You know, I murdered someone. I did this. I did that. And I hope this will help make it right in the eyes of, you know, humanity. And so this doctor, Chester Southam, would come here and bring HeLa cells. His assistant would actually bring them in her purse from New York, and they would just set up a sort of assembly line and just inject these men with HeLa cells. And in some cases, they grew. In almost all cases, I think in all cases here, their immune systems did fight them off. But it was part of this larger study. But that was actually the only group that he even told that he was doing this, there was no way he could have done it otherwise. And he went on. Eventually, he was injecting every woman who came into the gynecology service at Memorial Sloan Kettering with these cells. So hundreds and hundreds of people being injected with them. And at some point, he started a study at the Jewish Chronic Disease Hospital in Brooklyn, which, interestingly, was the first time he'd tried to do this with any Jewish patients in a Jewish hospital. And, this was not long after the revelations about the research that Nazis had done on Jews and the famous Nuremberg trials, where the Nazi doctors were put up on trial. And there was this code of ethics that came out of the Nuremberg trials that said you don't do research on people without their consent. It wasn't law, but it was, this sort of code of ethics mm-hmm. for the field. So he went to this Jewish hospital and said, I want to start injecting your patients with cancer cells. And a few of these Jewish doctors said, no, you can't do that. And he was doing it anyways. And so they sort of blew the story open and went to the press. And it resulted in this incredible, the first real big sort of U.S.-based story about unethical research on people. And that case is actually what led to the regulations we have now that, you can't do research on people without this IRB approval, this institutional review boards. Those came into existence
because
of that research.
So not only do you need the person's permission, you need it to be reviewed to make sure because the individual may not have the knowledge.
Yeah, so there's now a whole new level of oversight with research that, came from unethical research done using HeLa cells, which is
What struck me, sort of the kicker to that story, was that was just the tip of the iceberg. There were tens of thousands of research, of experiments going on out there along similar lines. This was just the one that busted through.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And at that point, once this story came out, people started looking into other research being done. And they were finding that, this guy was, exposing kids to hepatitis, and this guy was poisoning patients under anesthesia to study the right balance of oxygen versus anesthetic. And, the amazing sort of things that were being done to people without their knowledge was pretty horrifying.
614-292-8513 if you would like to call and speak with Rebecca Skloot. Abby, you're on the air talking with Rebecca Skloot.
Hi, it's great to talk with you. I just finished your book and it was really a great read.
Thank you.
So I actually missed the first part of the program, so I don't know if you discussed this yet, but what actually, the whole medical ethics thing and whether you can, use people's cells, I kind of understand part of the science of if we're going to keep proceeding, we need to have those available. But what really has stuck with me and from reading the book was the way her sister was treated in the institution. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I didn't see that coming, and it was just so horrible. And I don't know if you had discussed that or not.
No,
we hadn't. Actually, we were going to talk about the rest of her family, Abby. I'm glad you brought it up.
Yeah, and thank you for bringing it up. And I didn't see it coming either, and neither did Deborah. I mean, that part of the story, people often ask me, what was the most shocking thing you learned when you were doing the research on this book? And they often expect me to say something about Henrietta or something about, something about HeLa research. But in fact, it was the story of her older daughter, Elsie. And so the story of that, was that Elsie was deaf and epileptic. And right around the time that Henrietta got sick, she had also just had her fifth child, and her doctors said, you can't keep taking care of this sort of special needs kid. And they told her to send her to this institution that had been known as the Home for Crazy Negroes. And it was a really sort of a barbaric place. And, as many institutions were particularly in the South in the 50s, particularly if you were black. And Deborah always had this feeling that something bad had happened to her sister. Elsie died at 15. Deborah was very young. She never knew her sister. But she just always had this feeling, something bad happened to my sister and I have to figure out what it was. And so as part of my research for the book, I Deborah and I went to this institution, which is now called Crownsville State Hospital. And we went there and, yeah, we had no idea what we were going to find. And, you know, I ended up digging out some records and finding, you know, just that the place had been sort of inhuman in the way that people were treated. You know, people, it was so overcrowded that people were sleeping on, like, literally piled on top of each other. You know, male patients, you know, adult males with little girls, and sort of worst of all, that Elsie and a lot of the other children there were used in some pretty horrible research without anybody realizing it, with obviously without consent. And what was done to her sister was sort of more barbaric than anything that happened in the rest of the story. And it was so shocking. I mean, Deborah had always thought something had happened, but never could have imagined what actually did happen. And that was one of these moments in writing the story that, you know, she was sitting next to me when I found this information, and the scene in the book where we both are learning this at the same time. And it was so traumatic for her. That was one of the moments that I knew that, you know, all of this sort of had to be in the book, because I had put her there in this situation where she had learned this hard thing. And, you know, I kept saying, are you sure you want to keep going? This is really all, you know, don't you want me to go sort of learn this stuff and I can come tell you about it? And she would just say, no, I want to be there. I want to hear this stuff. I know it's hard, but she was so inspiring in her determination to learn what happened, sort of despite it being difficult. But yeah, that story is one of the hardest in the book, I think.
Yeah. Thanks for your call, Abby.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks.
There were other sad stories in the book. That was the most shocking, particularly because Elsie couldn't speak for herself.
She couldn't say anything, yeah.
She couldn't say anything. And Deborah was worried because what if something had happened to her and she couldn't tell anybody that was happening? And Deborah particularly was worried because she had been sexually molested for years after her mother died and wasn't there to protect her. And the kids, kids were just left.
Yeah, the story of Henrietta's children is after her death is so sad. And, you know, in a lot of ways, the story is about a lot of things.
Yes.
You know, it's about the importance of access to education. It's about the need to be able for scientists to be able to communicate with the general public about science. You know, it's about journalism. It's like there's so many stories. But in a lot of ways, at its core, it's also about, you know, what happens when you lose a mother. And the importance that sort of, you know, person can play in people's lives. So, you know, For Deborah, it was also about her big sister was gone, too. So Deborah grew up surrounded by men and was very badly abused. Her brothers were very badly abused as well. I mean, all of the children, some of it just really incredible abuse. And, you know, Deborah, as she was growing up and experiencing all this abuse, she held the idea of her mother and her sister in her head all the time. She would sort of fantasize about her mother and her sister, saying, if they were here, none of this would have happened. You know, if my mother had survived, if I had my big sister, everything would be fine. And she would sort of make up these stories about them in her head, since nobody would talk about them and she didn't know anything about them. So she spent most of her life really just sort of fixated on the idea of learning about them. And she felt this almost duty to protect them, even though they were gone. So for her, learning about what happened to her sister and her mother, however painful it was, she sort of needed to do that because she felt like she owed it to them. And when we found, you know, this information about what had been done with her sister, one of her first responses is, somebody should have told me. I would have come and saved her. I would never have let this happen to her. And, you know, she was 5 when her sister died. So, you know, but in her mind, she wanted to help her sister and her mother because she knew something bad had happened. And this was part of why her mother's cells being used in research was sort of traumatic for her initially, especially when she first would hear, you know, they're sending in cells to the moon and injecting them with chemicals. And, you know, they fused her, you know, HeLa cells with mouse cells to make these mouse-human hybrid cells. And, you know, this stuff all sounded like maybe someone was just still doing something bad to Henrietta. And she was very concerned about whether she needed to be protecting her mother still and whether this was somehow causing her pain. And I think all of this comes back to this idea of sort of the importance of, you know, a mother figure. And, you know, Deborah didn't have that and wanted it so badly and sort of wanted to do that for her sister and her mother as well.
You know, the fact that the family was so poor, you know, and ultimately billions and billions of dollars have been made from the research from Henrietta Lacks, the cells. There's another good story, though, from the West Coast about I can't think of his first name, right?
Mr. John Moore.
Moore. And we only have a few minutes, but that's
an amazing story.
Very
yeah.
easy to calculate. Someone got very, yeah. very rich off that.
Yeah. And it's an interesting story. So, yeah, very briefly, his doctor had taken some cells from him without him realizing it. His doctor patented them, and they were worth billions of dollars. And he eventually found out and sued. And, you know, the court ruled against him. So the court said patients have no property rights in their tissues. And that sort of stands today as our, you know, where the case lies. But you know, one of the things about this whole issue of money, and this is one of the places where scientists get concerned, is, you know, the number of cells that are actually worth anything is just tiny. You know, for all the billions and billions of cells out there, there's, you know, a tiny handful that are actually financially valuable, even scientifically valuable. The value of cells comes in their sort of mass quantities and being right. used as a tool on a larger scale. But this question of who should profit, and how do you deal with the fact that sometimes some of them are very valuable? And, you know, that's still a big question that people are talking about.
Yeah, it's scientists have argued that Henrietta's special cells mm-hmm. were just an accident of nature, accident of biology, and not something that she created or invented. And right. I sort of thought about fashion, you know, models or so someone who's very beautiful and they mm-hmm. can use that beauty to profit from their beauty, their physical attributes, or maybe somebody who's very smart and mm-hmm. can profit from their brilliance.
Yeah. And
isn't it all an accident?
Right. Yes. Yeah. And, you know, and the interesting thing, and I guess where it's complicated with the cells, is that if someone had just taken Henrietta's cells out of her body and put them in a dish and done nothing with them, they would have died. So part yeah. of where this gets complicated is that you had to have intervention from scientists to get them to grow. There was all this complicated technology that George Guy developed and, you know, the special stuff right. for feeding the cells and this and that. And this is where people get sort of stuck with the idea of how should you deal with the commercialization of cells and who should profit when they can't do that without the raw materials. But then the raw materials won't go anywhere without the scientists either. So it's this, you know, there's so many things that are involved in it.
Symbiotic relationship. Mm-hmm. Rebecca Skloot, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a very interesting book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Skloot. She will be at OSU tonight for a reading. Book signing at 7 p.m. If you want to know more, go to wosu.org/allsides, and we'll have a link there for you with more information. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.